back to the Reagan Red Zone. I'm Webb Millward, and we're thrilled that you've joined us. I'm excited today to welcome to the Red Zone Harrison Brooks and Mark Kreitz, two partners with Reagan. Guys, I'm excited. There's a great energy in the room this morning for two reasons. One, we've cast aside all the old curmudgeons at Reagan for this podcast, and we're bringing in the young guns. And two, today is the start of the Masters Golf Tournament just down the road here in Augusta. So it's a great day to be alive. For all of our listeners, thank you for joining us, and let's get started. Today, we're going to take a slight departure from our usual Red Zone topic, which is highlighting metrics from the growth and profitability survey that Reagan performs every quarter. I do want to mention, however, that the Q1 GPS is currently open. You are able to participate, and we certainly encourage you to do so. For those of you not as familiar, GPS tracks the real-time value drivers in the insurance brokerage space. It measures your performance against the best of the best, and it's something that we think is a really great tool for your firm to use. But with that, today we are going to focus on a recent event that we hosted. We hosted an event a couple weeks ago in New York called Investor Connect. We went out and invited institutional capital firms, private equity, and family offices to a meeting in New York. Why? Like most things in this business, relationships are important. Given the transformative role that private equity and institutional capital has played in our industry over the years, we felt it important to lean into that community, to better understand their investment strategy and current appetites, and to continue to develop those relationships. We were excited that over 50 firms joined us in New York for this conversation. So what's the value to a broker? For those of you listening, the value primarily was education, awareness, and connection. To be clear, we are not driving our clients into the warm and welcoming embrace of private equity, but as we see it, institutional capital is already flourishing in our space. It does not seem to be going anywhere anytime soon, and we want to make sure our clients are well informed. So guys, welcome to the Red Zone. I've always been focused in my career on the brokerage community. That's my background and how I see the world. Uniquely, each of you once worked in the investor world prior to your time joining Reagan. You've lived it and you understand the dynamics. And then fortunately for us at Reagan, you got smart, you saw the light, you realized that the insurance brokerage space is the greatest industry in the world. So we're thrilled you made that pivot. But interested to hear your insights today as we talk about this conversation. So for the sake of this discussion, let's just say I'm a broker. I'm in that seat and I run a thriving privately held firm. My independence is super important to me, and I really like having control. So why do investors love me? And let's talk about some of the fundamentals.
Well, Webb, that's a pretty narcissistic way to start the conversation. Why do investors love you? But that's par for the course for you. So excited to talk about it today.
Yeah, we did. We definitely saw the bright side here. And so this is Mark Kreitz, and I'm going to dive in first, Harrison, and just give you my thoughts on how we have seen investors kind of change the landscape in insurance distribution. And first off, just having this conversation right now, the ability for us to have this event signals that this has really changed. Our industry has changed quite a bit in just the last 10 to 15 years. And really what these investors have done is basically instill a vote of confidence on the operating model that our industry has. Whether it be family offices, private equity firms, long-term, institutionally-minded pension funds, firms of that nature, we have seen just a plethora of folks dive in and invest in the space. And really, that accelerated after the Great Recession. Folks were looking for a stable asset class. Real estate had just gone in the tank, and looked no further than insurance distribution. Why is insurance distribution so appealing to an investor? Well, I got a few things, Harrison, and I'd certainly want your opinion on this as well. But the five or six things that we have seen investors really focus on as they invest in this space. Number one is this is a recurring revenue model. Significantly high persistency, even for the firms that are in the bottom quartile from a performance standpoint. Firms that are only, you know, bottom quartile only capture 80 to 85, maybe even 90% of their business every year. That's pretty strong. Number two is they have embedded trusted expertise. They are relationship driven, and there have been lots of firms, technology firms try to displace the broker and just has not worked. The relationship does matter. There's virtually no capital expenditure requirements, limited working capital as well, and lots of free cash flow. These brokers operate at very healthy margins. And then kind of lastly, what I'd say is it is a resilient business in economic cycles. Think back to 2009 in our GPS survey, as Webb mentioned earlier, the average broker declined just under 2%, while the rest of the market declined maybe 30 or 40% during that Great Recession. But those are the key things that we see investors really enamored with in our space.
So Webb, there you go. That's why you're awesome, and you've got your talking points for your next cocktail party.
Keep the love coming my way. So Harrison, what's in it for me then as the broker? What's in it for me? Why should I engage in this conversation?
Yeah, I think it's interesting to tune out the noise and say, private equity, I don't want to be involved with that. I want to be independently and privately owned. And that's great. But I would just say education is a powerful thing. You know, in that room, there's a lot of smart and successful people in that room. And it is super interesting just to have a conversation and ask them through their lens what they think is attractive about your business and what they believe are the key value drivers of growth. Too often, I think owners of businesses in the brokerage community just get sucked into running the day-to-day businesses and don't necessarily zoom out to really think about how do I put things in place to drive value. And I would say if you are thinking about taking on capital, there's a diamond in the rough out there. As we worked in this space, it's very competitive for institutional investors to find a high-quality broker that is like-minded, that wants to grow their firm rapidly. And if you find that right investor, there are unique characteristics to them where they don't all feel the same, but you have to have cups of coffee. You have to get to know these people. Things like, hey, are you willing to stay in my business and be an investor for the next 10 or 20 years? Are you gonna take minority equity? Are you gonna change the way I run my business? Do I have to report to you? What does that look like? And I think if you find that trust and that engagement, there are folks out there that don't feel like the traditional typical model of, well, I took on investors, I just lost my independence. It's a tool, it's not the end all be all.
It's a nice reminder for all of us that just like brokers are unique and have different models and different legacies and different focuses, that private equity firms, institutional capital, all have different focus areas, different models, they engage differently, and I think it's a nice reminder. It's not all one and the same. So let's move forward a little. So what's changed in the marketplace? Specifically, why is this conversation in the room, the one between brokers and investors, why is it different than the one they would have had 2 or 3 years ago?
Mark? Yeah, and I may even back up 10 to 15 years, because I think the long looking back in time allows us to understand what has really transformed in our industry. And so if you think back to the Great Recession, as I mentioned earlier, you had this dynamic where investors were hungry for capital deployment. And so over the last 10 to 15 years, we've seen this supply and demand shift in our space, where the demand in some cases has outweighed the supply of available large firms. And so you have seen these massive billion-dollar brokers basically built over a 10 to 15 year period with names that may have not even existed before the Great Recession. And so, yeah, that was a long-term low interest rate environment, but the demand for our industry has accelerated for the things I mentioned above. And so today, looking around the space, there are upwards of 60 plus active acquirers. When you think about retail, wholesale, specialty, strategic buyers, and most of those firms are backed by institutional capital. And so you have this significant demand that has taken place that has basically shifted to, in a consolidating world, you have a demand that is outweighing, in some cases, supply of large agencies available for partnership. And number two, I'd say, and then Harrison, I want to hear more about maybe the last couple of years that has really shifted, but the performance of our industry, in particular over the last few years, has been significantly stronger than maybe it has historically. We've been in a hard market. We have seen COVID reduce expenses in selling areas, in occupancy. We're in a remote environment in many cases. We're selling over Zoom and Teams. It's a different world, but you've seen the hard market propel double-digit organic growth the last few years, While we've been an industry that lives in the single digit growth wise, we have accelerated that over the last few years while also producing record level profitability, which has given cash flows back to investors, allowed them to just generate really, really strong returns. But Harrison, what do you think has kind of transformed the last couple of years that would make even, you know, more sense for what's changed?
Yeah, I think we've just, Mark, I don't disagree with anything you said, but I would just say we've seen an acceleration in those trends you just stated. Supply and demand and performance of brokers. We're reaching all-time high performance numbers driven primarily by the hard market, and we're seeing fewer firms, I think, of high quality selling. And you hear this when you talk to buyers. I think the question for the first time at this event was asked, are we gonna run out of firms to buy? Mm. And there's still 40,000 independent brokers in the US. A lot of those are smaller now because they spun out of direct writers. But you are gonna continue to see supply and demand creating record high valuations for best in class assets. That's not slowing down. The quality though of the deals, there will be this driving quality kind of comparison of what those folks that are buying quality are going to see higher prices being paid, but they're gonna be continuing to do deals for high quality brokerages. Interest rates, if we the current interest rate environment, that's changed dramatically over the past 24 months. And even with the increase in the cost of capital over what was basically free money, you know, over the past 10 years, if you look back over the past 10 years, some brokers are taking on preferred equity, which is essentially just like a form of debt. And that preferred equity, there's interest rates that cost 20% to get that capital, meaning they've used up their debt capital, they had to go get more money, and they're paying 20%, and they're still going and buying brokerages. Those are some sophisticated institutional investors that are saying, I'll pay 20% for my capital and I can still make a return on that. That's pretty wild. And then lastly, I would just say minority capital, the thought of someone coming into your business, writing you a check, allowing an owner to take some chips off the table, but doing that in a minority position used to be a unicorn. It used to be a concept. The thought of, hey, I'll have a family office who's patient and will be in my business and invested for the next 10, 20, 30 years, that seemed like a unicorn concept. And to now, that actually exists. That actually is possible. And so I think you've just seen an acceleration, and that's largely driven by the fact that brokers have earned the right with their performance track record.
Great. Yeah, we're going to talk more about minority equity here in a minute. So with that as a setup, guys, let's kind of recap the agenda for the listeners. And while doing that, I want to hear kind of your one or two key takeaways from our day in New York. So we're going to go through four sections of the agenda here in this conversation, and we'll just tick through them one by one. Number one, we talked a lot about valuation trends and the M&A landscape. If you had one kind of key takeaway from that section, what would it be? Let's talk about that.
Yeah, valuation trends. We continually are asked by our clients or investors, buyers, prices can't still be at all-time highs. It just can't happen. Interest rates have changed. The supply of firms has been fairly robust, albeit to Harrison's point, perhaps the quality of firms that are actively in market or looking for a partner has diminished slightly. Valuations from our perspective have remained pretty consistent year over year. So if we think back to when the interest rates came up, we're still seeing for firms that are between $3 and $10 million of revenue, high quality operating firms, that they can still receive a guaranteed multiple of maybe 12 and a half times at closing on their pre-tax cash flow or EBITDA. That's the same as it was last year. And with an interest rate environment that's changing, pretty interesting, but that speaks to the demand of folks that Harrison just mentioned. We just have tons of capital ready to invest in this space because it is so attractive, and they've found just such strong returns. But
Mark, pause there for a second. How do you define high quality? Yeah. Give me three or four characteristics that would define high quality for an agency.
Size matters even more today than it had historically. There have been lots of consolidation, and if you're producing and you have a sizable firm, 5, 10, 15, 20 million and up, you are more attractive to a buyer because they're buying more revenue. The second is growth is more important today than it was maybe even five, 10 years ago. We're in a hard market. If you're not keeping up with the hard market and you're not growing, people are asking why. If you are specialized versus a generalist, that is super, super important because likely you're growing faster than others that are not specialized. And then, are you investing in young talent? Are you a youthful organization that is really looking for the next sales talent or are investing in new producers, investing in new service team members, investing in new executives? Those are the four things that I would point to, Harrison.
That's cool. And Webb, I would just say my one takeaway from the kind of the M&A and valuation trends was really the slowdown in deal activity in 2023. We saw a deceleration from 2022, does not tell the whole story. Mm-hmm. If anything, I would say we're about to see a pretty large rebound in 2024 in M&A activity. And the main culprit of that slowdown here in the short term was just interest rates, but it doesn't tell the full story. The market's healthy, it's robust. Investors' appetite is at all-time highs. I mean, as evidenced that who attended and was in that room with 40 plus institutional investors.
And a lot of major players reloading on capital at the end of last year that probably aren't going to sit on the sidelines much longer, right?
Yeah.
And what were those guys doing last year? I mean, what was the big buzzword of 23 that we heard around the industry, Harrison?
Yeah, when rates went up and people had to hit the pause button on doing M&A activity, there was a lot of discussion around integration. So firms that were acquiring a ton of firms paused and said, hey, we need to integrate. So that's been the buzzword. So Webb, another little tip for you at your next cocktail party as a broker, you can just throw around the word integration and people are going to think you're really smart.
I'm showered.
They'll probably buy
you
a drink.
Yeah. That's right. So agenda item number two here, and we're kind of touching around it, so let's dive into this, is minority equity. Really some recent and exciting developments with regard to firms taking on minority capital. We've got some great examples right now that are playing out in front of us. And so what is this? What does this phenomenon look like? What's the impact of it? And is it also, why is it an attractive kind of alternative path to someone that maybe doesn't want to jump all the way in to a full-on capital partner?
Yeah, so I'll first define what it is, right? If you think about access to capital in our space historically, you know, you really rewind the clock, it's I can go get some debt, borrow it from the bank, or I could sell my firm to a strategic acquirer. And there wasn't a lot in between. Well, institutional investors, family offices and private equity firms have filled that gap. They first filled that gap where they would come to a broker like yourself, Webb, and say, I'll buy 70% of your firm and you keep 30. That was the model for a really long time. Now, we're seeing that flip. Institutional investors are coming to a broker and saying, I'll buy 30% and you keep 70, which is crazy from an investor's perspective as that's not their DNA to say, I'll sit in the back seat and you drive the car. It is much more, they like to drive the car and you sit in the back seat, right? That's the perception of institutional investors. And so what is minority equity? We kind of typically define this as a less than 50% investment in an independent broker. And I will zoom in even more on that and say kind of, I'll define what we're seeing a big trend of is the independent minority outside equity, meaning firms like Higginbotham, IMA, Heffernan, are just examples, Unison, are examples of firms that have taken on that less than 50% outside equity investment from an institutional investor. So it's a super regional independent broker that takes a less than 50% stake in the firm. And it's interesting, we looked at those firms that I just mentioned, Higginbotham, Heffernan, IMA, Unison, Lolly, who we just recently did a capital raise for with the Pritzker family, that group of firms has done in the past, Mark, what was this, Dad? 3 years?
No, since 17.
Since 2017,
yep.
They've done $850 million in revenue acquired with a transaction value of $3.5 billion. And how many transactions would that represent approximately, Mark?
Almost 200 transactions, and just if you think about the value there, that's over four times revenue being on average paid for firms, and you'll have larger firms skewing that up, smaller firms skewing that down, but if you think about a blended multiple, that's a pretty healthy value.
So they've done a lot of M&A, but what else, to Webb's earlier point, Mark, would you say is attractive about that model?
Yeah, I think that your analogy was good. Folks that are interested in accelerating their growth and having issues internally with respect to evaluation, this is an opportunity to reset your market valuation, while maintaining control of your business, you own the majority of the business, you get access to debt capital, to more equity capital, you can build an M&A engine if that's something that you would like to do and compete better with a new valuation. And at that point, you have an investor that may not have an exit date. That would be a stipulation you would actually ask for if you went to market and say, I want you to invest in my business, but I want a long-term horizon. I want you to continue to be, you know, I can replace you in 5-7 years, great, but I want this access to capital to be perpetual to allow me to do what I want to do from an M&A perspective and a perpetuation perspective. That's why some of these firms have capitalized on this initiative.
Yeah, that's great. You know, another really exciting development over the last few years, and really a phenomenon you could probably call it, is the surge of the wholesale and MGA space. And we felt it important on the agenda, not just to talk about the retail space, right, but to talk about specialty distribution, talk about the key components of what the wholesale space, the MGA world, is looking at with regard to the industry. So any thoughts there, Mark, from you off the top?
Yeah, we have referred to this, these really last 5 years, as the golden age of the excess and surplus lines market. And what, looking at statistics, there was about $50 billion in premium over a long period of time. In just the last 5 years, that accelerated to $100 billion. And market share is increasing for these specialty distribution wholesale MGA firms. And so this market has outpaced the broader distribution market at a whole. And so that was my big takeaway, is that there is shifting market share from traditional market carrier access into this E&S market, given the inherent riskiness that we're seeing in the world with cyber events, with different natural disasters. We're just seeing this specialty broker really emerge as a significant player in the market.
Webb, you led that session, and so it probably received the lowest like scores.
Probably the best part of the day, yeah.
Probably the lowest scores of any session.
I've been getting a lot of fan mail about it, but uh-huh. We can talk about that.
What were your big takeaways? So Mark said it's been like the golden age over the past 5 years. What are the highlights? What drove that?
I see five reasons for the surge in the wholesale space, and it's really interesting when you break it down. I think number one, the persistent hard market that we've experienced over that same time period. Number two would be a talent exodus of talent moving from large insurers and popping out and forming their own delegated units. A lot of underwriting experience and going out and getting some capital, right? As we've just established, the capital is available and it's eager to support them. If you've been in the industry 20 years and you've got the credentials and the experience, your ability to get that capital and start your own shop is pretty high. And then certainly innovation and technology, the ability to get your arms around data analytics, how you access that data, the modeling that can come from it. Just a really exciting time in the space. And then lastly, favorable ratings, right? The ratings agencies being able to say, we know you're brand new, but here's an A-minus rating and we wish you the best. And so I think there's a lot of reasons why that's a really attractive space right now. We're seeing a lot of growth. Any last comments there before we move forward?
No.
Great. So let's talk a little bit about the future of brokerage. Our last section was on the future of brokerage. Bobby Reagan on our team interviewed Dan Glazer. Everyone knows Dan. What's interesting, Dan has moved from kind of being in an operator role with Marsh into an investor role now. And a lot in the news lately about he and his firm's efforts. But what are your all's thoughts about the future of brokerage and the evolution here of private equity?
Yeah, that was awesome. I mean, Dan's got tons of experience. And so the thing that stuck out to me, Webb, was that scale in Dan's mind doesn't necessarily mean you have a competitive advantage. It can
doesn't
solve your issues unless it's harnessed effectively. And so you can't just amass scale for scale purpose. You have to have a purpose and an effective game plan to ultimately harness that scale.
Yeah, and my takeaway was really, Dan gave this image of an institutional investor's role in a healthy partnership as a hand on the operator's back, a steady hand on your back, pushing you to do things that you wouldn't necessarily quite be comfortable doing on your own, or hitting that next notch of growth. And that was just a cool image for me to see him say, hey, there's that steady hand on your back, which I think we can all appreciate. In running our businesses, it's like, hey, yeah, it would be have someone there to kind of be my business coach, right? But if you push too hard, it's a shove, it doesn't work. And so that's
motivation.
Motivation. That steady hand was kind of what I took away.
Yeah, I'm trying to move from maybe status quo, which is still a good business, into really building value and being more disruptive and growing more exponentially in my firm. And if I don't have that accountability partner internally, maybe it's something I can find on the outside. So To everyone's favorite part of the Red Zone, we have now reached the two-minute drill. Two questions for you guys as we wrap this conversation up. So for me, the broker, what are the pros and what are the cons of engaging an institutional investor? And you guys have been pretty harmonious today so far, but I'm looking for a little bit of disagreement in this final section. So what are the pros of engaging institutional capital?
While private equity and the institutional investor may be viewed as the dark side, and yes, Harrison and I have converted, we do see a lot of advantages to this model and to opportunities for broker. And I'll just say a quick few things. You can reset your value at market levels. And today, more than ever, you have an internal versus external dilemma from a value perspective. You can be more competitive in M&A. You can have outside board members, and to Dan's point, give you that slight push on the back to nudge you in the right direction, good motivation. And then you can continue to provide wealth opportunities for employees at each event. You give equity back into the employees' hands. Those are just a few, but I would say, Harrison, I see a lot of positives here.
Yeah, and I'm going to take the disadvantages. So I think on this podcast in particular, we've tried to present the case for how private equity institutional investors can help potentially accelerate growth. That being said, it is not the solution for everyone. And there are disadvantages to it, for sure. I think the biggest one is your reduced control over your business or loss of control. You're not going to make every single decision like the way you do it today. You're going to have that accountability partner, and do you want that? The beauty of being privately held is that you are privately held and you make your decisions. You are accountable to yourself, and really only yourself and your business partners that sit around the table. That is not something to be taken lightly. No contract can protect you. You can find the most like-minded investors, and if the numbers aren't going the right way, it's not going to be a really comfortable situation. Number two, as you think about restructuring your capital base, what do I mean by that? You might need to rethink your distributions. A lot of brokers out there love to distribute all the profits of your agency and take home a lot of cash every year. In an institutional investor situation where they're investing in your business, they're going to push you to say, hey, take less cash and put it in your pocket and reinvest it in your business and acquisitions or producer hiring to accelerate growth, which does create wealth, but
long term,
but cash is king, right? I might want that capital today. Mm-hmm. And another negative is, do they really help you strategically on the tools and resources side of your business? If you really think about this, they're institutional investors. They can move the needle a little bit, but like, safety, laws control, risk of compliance, like, do they really help you from a resource perspective? And then lastly, you know, I would just say for a lot of brokers out there, they're organic growth first organizations. They don't want to have to do a ton of deals. And if you take on institutional capital, they want you to start doing some deals. And those would be kind of the key things I would highlight in terms of the disadvantages.
Yeah, it's interesting. It always comes back to that balance of autonomy and resources, right? We want to maintain as much autonomy as we've enjoyed over our generations of being in business, but also some resources could really help us out, compete against scale, and continue to grow. So always an interesting dynamic. So as we close, guys, let's bring this home. What happens now? Let's talk about the final two or three things here, where we go from here.
Yeah, you know, we're getting calls, I think, most weeks from new investors looking to get into the space, or those looking for the next recap opportunity for a large independent regional firm, a large broker that already has capital. You know, Harrison,
More or less investors.
More investors. There will be more investors in our space in 2024 than there were in 2023 or 2022. It's just such a great industry that people want to be in.
Perfect. I'd say more brokers taking on outside capital, minority capital. I think you're going to see some big names take on institutional investors on a minority basis, like we've seen this growing trend. And then number three, if interest rates go down, strap on your seatbelts. The M&A market is about to get wild.
Yeah, we're excited to see how this plays out over the next year. Certainly will be an interesting conversation when we get to New York in 2025 for Investor Connect. But thank you both for joining the Red Zone today, and thank you all for listening. We look forward to seeing you next time. Yeah.